Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence, and by Chevrolet, the all-new Chevrolet Cruze. Get used to more.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 95 for Thursday, March 17th, 2011. Do the right thing. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLineDetroit.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine After Hours in the iTunes Store. Thanks for being back with us, folks. And as always, I'm joined by Mr. D. Lorenzo.
John, how are you?
Have my baseball
jacket on. I'm ready for the season.
You do have a baseball jacket on.
Yes, I do.
So you are ready for the season. It feels like spring out there right now.
For 5 minutes until you look at next week's weather report. When it'll be in the upper 30s all week.
Oh, yeah. I'll get my skis on again. And also joining us tonight, Sharon Turlip from the Wall Street Journal. Great having you here, Sharon.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
And so, just so if anybody doesn't know, you cover exactly what for the Journal?
I cover mostly GM, so I cover, kind of all auto industry issues, but we have quite a few reporters covering that, so I stick to GM like glue.
And back with us again, as he's been here a number of times, is Scott Burgess. And I can't say of the Detroit News because you're no longer there. And Scotty, you got to tell us what the hell is going on here.
I resigned. I officially resigned on. There was a couple of days involved in the resignation,
and as you thought about this.
No, as I turned in a resignation, and then I talked with people at the paper, and then talked about it again, and then submitted it again on Wednesday.
So they asked you not to resign.
Yes.
I mean, so that's why you resubmitted it.
Yeah. And first of all, resigning in public is not nearly as much fun as you could imagine. And I haven't enjoyed
it. We'll get into that in a minute. I'm laughing in anticipation, not at it.
But the paper and I disagreed on a matter of editing a story. It happened last Friday.
On the Chrysler 200.
The Chrysler 200 review.
You tore it up pretty good.
Yeah.
I thought it was balanced. I mean, you said some good things about it, too.
You can find good things in there.
Right.
It deserved to be torn up. Come on. I just refuse to accept the homers in this town who are just, everything Chrysler does is great and everything, blah, blah. The 200 sucks, okay? They refreshened a piece of shit. It's still a piece of shit. I don't care what they do. And your review is dead accurate.
The thing is, and it really what came down on the basis of writing it, is when you compare that car with any other mid-size car.
It doesn't compare very well.
The other car wins.
Yeah.
And so it's, yes, it was very harsh.
Is that the harshest one you've ever written?
No. You can go back and look up my smart car review.
That should fit in the dumpster, I think.
Yeah.
The lines of that one.
Yeah. And there's lots of times, I'm very guilty of giving backhand compliments to stuff. But the editing of it, of the review, was not ever a question of something that I would worry about. Things are edited all the time. You could edit just for space that it doesn't fit on the physical page. I quit because of the motivation behind the editing on this particular one.
Now, of course, the word is that some Chrysler dealer allegedly called in to complain.
I've never heard it was a dealer. I've only heard it was an advertiser.
Oh, an advertiser.
And
okay.
And at the time, I think that the paper thought what they were doing was good, and this was a nice way to do it.
Chrysler advertises on that site.
And they told me what to cut. I cut it. I went home and told my wife, I have to quit my job. And since then, it's been a very big mess.
And now, I think everybody in this business has had an editor go at their copy, and no writer in the world likes somebody taking their copy, but this is obviously different for you.
Well, the original story had already run. This was 36 hours later or so that these changes came. From what I've heard, what the paper has said, that they think that now that this has been handled incorrectly, that it was a mistake. And I agree.
That's what they say. Are you agree?
They say that.
That you agree.
No, well, they say that it was a mistake, and I agree with them that it was a mistake.
Okay.
I can't
just clarify
the news.
Right. Yeah.
And that's why I put in my resignation. I actually went up to the EPA on Monday, and that was my first stop, and it was because of the eco car.
Yeah.
And I thought I might not have to write that story, but after going up there, I said, no, well, I still got to write about these guys. They didn't do anything wrong. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I filed the story and then
submitted your resignation.
Yes.
So, I mean, if they're admitting a mistake, would you go back?
I don't know, because I see half statements.
Because I think they've mishandled this, you know, totally. I mean, that's my vantage point, and I'm not just saying it because you're sitting here on the show with us. But, you know, that's a real issue, I think, in any kind of a publication, is this church versus state, editorial versus sales and or business side of things. And everybody who's ever been an editorial knows
right.
We're the ones always under pressure. So I think all of us have been through maybe not exactly the same kind of a situation you've been through, because never in my career have I ever had anything changed on me based on what an advertiser said. I've had copy editors change things and had them tone down stuff for me, or maybe explain it a little bit better than I had written, but never had in my career something changed because of an advertiser.
I've had tons of things changed. And that's all part of the process.
You mean in the normal editorial process?
Normal editorial process. I've always welcomed people to go in and offer suggestions and let's say this differently. Let's talk about that. I mean, Sharon and I worked in the same newsroom and you would say, does this sound good? And that's in bad taste or that's in anything. And that happens all the time. But I think that once that paper goes to print, any changes that you're doing after that, and we've changed stuff online before, and the only things that we've changed online before have been I mistook the Cummins diesel as a 8-cylinder. Who would ever think a 6.7 is a 6, straight 6?
Yeah.
And I was sloppy.
So for factual stuff, it gets changed.
Absolutely. And there's nothing wrong with that, mm-hmm. and you should do that. But in this case, you know, I disagree with the motivation.
But now, tell me if I'm not wrong. I went and looked at the site last night, looked at it again today with your review in it. They've taken all the edits out. They put back what they took out.
Some of that is because of the way the Detroit News Online does caching. If you were to go through it the one way, it was all still the unedited version, but they haven't contacted me and said that we've put the original story back.
Well, like I said, I went there twice because I just wanted to. In fact, I saw somebody in the comments on Jalopnik had suggested, they wrote something that wasn't very well written. I went, wait a minute, do they mean that the news put all the edits back in? And went to the site, searched your story, found it, and was like, oh my gosh, all the stuff that was edited out via, you know, Jalopnik having printed the original and showed what was taken out, I was able to make that comparison and went again this morning and it's back. If I'm reading it right, the original is back on there.
Yeah, nobody has ever sent anything to me.
Well, that's what I find very puzzling, why they would take the stand and then back off their own stand. So that's why it's kind of weird.
Well, at the end of the day, you have to. I spoke with my brother today, and I'll make this quick, but my brother, he pointed out a really good point, which is, why is it a big deal if somebody does the right thing?
That's a good question.
And it really isn't a big deal, and I think that I did the right thing, and that's all I have to go with, is doing the right thing. And I know that we want to talk about ethics, and that's what it comes down to. What is the right thing? If it feels wrong, then it's probably wrong, and you shouldn't do it. And if you make changes to a story because you're being told to do it and it doesn't feel right, then you shouldn't do it. And I take full blame there. I could have stood up right then. And I'll readily admit that when it's happening, you're like, oh, shit. What am I supposed to do? I've got this great job. I've got a mortgage payment. I've got a really crappy economy to deal with. And so I delayed.
Yeah. Well, you made a real gutsy move, obviously, for exactly the reasons you just cited.
Yeah, there was no other motivation behind it. That's why I did it.
But one second. Should I read Kurt's letter?
Why not?
You think it's okay? Okay, we got a letter in here from one of the Toyota guys, who we all deal with in the business, Kurt McAllister, who says, please take a few minutes to discuss Scott Burgess's resignation on tonight's show. Many people in the journalism and PR community, including myself, believe that the Detroit News was in error in their web editing of Scott's recent review. He's one of the best reviewers in the industry, and it's a shame that the news sacrificed journalistic integrity to assuage the grumbles of a supposed advertiser. And I think that's a real powerful statement. I really applaud Kurt for writing that, because here's the car company people coming and backing you up. And, I mean, they want you to write exactly what you think. That's why you're doing what you're doing.
We've all met people that don't, that they just put kids' gloves on and go through the motions. And you lose readers, and it becomes ineffective for the car maker to have that person even review a car. Why spend the time in a vehicle? And if you could be wrong, and, you know, I don't see myself as being all-knowing by any means. And I've had plenty of email exchanges with readers where they don't like my review. And that's perfectly all right, too. You know, it's hard to say your opinion is wrong. It could be misinformed. And I think that nowadays so many cars are so good coming out of the blocks. You know, we really nitpick on stuff. And so, I mean, whatever review you read or when you put them together, I think that you can get a consensus of what's a good vehicle and what's a bad vehicle. If all of us talk about the 200 and none of us are going, well, it's really great and I can't wait to buy mine. I think that, you know, there's the truth through consensus.
Sure, and it seems to me the journal probably really keeps this church and state separation. At least that's my impression.
Yeah, and I mean, I think the distinction that Scott's drawing is an important one. It's when what you edit before it shows up in the paper is a whole different ballgame between in terms of what you edit after it shows up. And I think that's the real difference. And you know, it is new territory with online and with the fact that we can change things quickly. We just don't have an option with the paper. As far as it goes with us, we change factual errors online. We generally will, run a correction and say, this story's been changed. But we definitely get pressure. I ran a story that had to do with a politician who was not a friend of the Detroit automakers and got quite popular in not being a friend to the Detroit automakers. But he, in an interview, he said, I think the bailout, he said positive things about the bailout, and it ended up running shortly before the election. And so they called that day just, demanding that it be altered, that story get altered online. And they pushed all the way to New York. I mean, but the decision was that, we can't open the door to just kind of changing things and fudging things once they've already run in the paper. And if it was true enough to run in print, then it has to be true enough to run online. So,
that's a great point.
But yeah, and I think, of course there's always, papers get put out on deadline. There's a rush. I mean, I can understand the urge to say, well, we want to do things, better now that we have more time. But I think it's really dicey territory and the motivations are important it's not an easy situation.
So, Peter, you've been on the advertising side. You're probably clubbing these editorial types.
I want to resign every other week from Auto Extremis. I keep sending my resignation letter back. Yeah, I've been on both sides. I've been, I respect what Scott did. I think it was the right thing to do. Absolutely. I think the news is wrong. You're always going to get pressure from advertisers. I'm in a different situation now, but when I was in the agency business, I was on the other side of that. But now I just get hate mail on a regular basis from disgruntled PR directors that happen to be hired down by the Detroit River, but that's okay.
Well, it's also the changing or the evolution we see of the media itself.
Everything all the time.
And it's all there's lots and lots of startups. Newspapers do not have the money that they the Detroit News certainly doesn't. And even 20 years ago, the newspapers just printed money. And so they could pay for everything they wanted to do.
Right.
And there's very few publications. And I think that's bad for readers and consumers if we only have the Wall Street Journal's point of view, because they're the only one that's Wall Street Journal and USA Today and a couple other big newspapers, because they're the only ones that have the money to buy ethical behavior.
No, that's a really good point, because when you look at what's going on in terms of, well, hold on a second. We've got some people in here shooting some things right now. But yeah, what is ethical when you're a journalist covering this business? Because the car companies launch their cars at these beautiful resorts in all different places in the world, you know, and I know you guys, certainly at the Wall Street Journal, Sharon, you've got pretty good travel and expense budget. I've never been at a magazine or a publication that had the kind of budget to do what you're talking about, of paying for the editorial staff to be able to go and travel to these places. So you have to go, if you really want to go and cover these cars, if you don't have the budget, you're on the car company's dime. And so that gets into a whole nother ethical area, because do you take the car company's money to go do that, or do you not cover it and let all your competition go do it? And, you know, you can only do that for so long, and then you're out of business. So it's a very funny kind of business in that sort of sense, in that there's not clear ethical lines, and you've got to draw your own, I think, because what works in one area definitely doesn't work in another. I'll give you a good example of that. Earlier in my career, I was with ABC, and they started this whole thing where, okay, if anybody takes you to a lunch, they can't spend more than $50 on that lunch. Other than that, you know, then they're like buying you off. And, you know, I started to say, wait a minute, this is 20 years ago. So a $50 lunch 20 years ago was very different than what it was today. But the rule still applies, because I said, you know, this was a meeting in New York. I said, for you guys in New York, $50 is not much to get by on lunch. I said, in Detroit, I'll take my staff to lunch. We'll go to a great restaurant. We'll have a great time. So, and besides, what if the bill came to $50.25? Am I suddenly unethical? And that's what I'm getting into here is, as an automotive journalist, where do you start to draw the ethical line? And I think it's totally blurry, and it's probably unlike just about any other business.
I don't know if that's true. I think that it's the political reporters that do all of those different things and go to all those dinners and you know, the White House Correspondents' Dinner that they just had recently, and were they sponsored for the table that they went to, and who was the sponsor for the table that they went to. And, you know, I mean, ultimately, your ethics, and I think auto journalists have to deal with this, or is what's inside you. What are you going to do?
It's your inner barometer.
Yeah. And
That's the best way to put it, Peter.
If it goes off, you got to say, hold on a second. And if it's not, and it should be, you should probably ask yourself, wait a second, this is not right. And, I mean, wasn't there a Supreme Court judge talking about obscenity? I don't know what it is. You know, I don't know. I can't define it exactly, but I know it when
see
it.
When I see it, right. And art critics have said that, too.
I don't know if car critics said that. But you should know. And if you know and you have that pitted feeling in your stomach and you go, this is not right, then you should stop.
That's right.
You know, I had the original idea for Auto Extremist in 86. It was going to be a car magazine that didn't take any advertising. It was going to be just hardcore enthusiasts. We'll say whatever we want to say because we wouldn't be beholden. You know, so I started at, 99? And I still don't get, you know, occasionally we do reviews in Auto Extremist. Not very often, because we don't get cars, because a lot of manufacturers will not let me near their cars, BMW in particular. But that, I know why that. That's a little, goes back to a personal thing. But I can't get BMWs, and I occasionally get interesting stuff to drive, but, you know, they don't like what I write, so they're not going to give me their vehicles, which, you know, but in today's business, you know, if someone's going to send me a car or truck to drive, yeah, I'm going to drive it. I mean, I put gas in it before I give it back, uh-huh. usually. And, you know, that's my, but I'm somewhat dependent if they want to give me something to drive. Otherwise, I'm not going to write about it. Or what we've done before is we've gone and borrowed them from people who have them. And then
uh-huh.
that really pisses the manufacturers off. Well, wait a minute. We could have controlled that. Controlled what?
Yeah.
He went and got a car from someone, and I, you know.
That's right.
Well, what if the manufacturer set something up at Silver Lake? And you're going to take the Ford Raptor and jump the first dune. And they pay your admission to that. And they've put the gas in the car. And they've trailered a truck all the way over there. And do all of those things. And
but if they don't, they don't get it reviewed.
Right. And you don't get that photo. And you don't get the things that'll help your publication.
Sure.
And, you know, if they bought an ad in your paper and paid $10,000 for the ad and got a front page story, and it only costs $4,000 from the ad side, that's plus, and not including the fact that you got people in the vehicle and you got opinions. They take a big risk. Every time they give you a car, they take a risk that you're going to come back and say, this car's a dud.
Way back in the 50s, and I only, from hearsay,
I think it's unfree to talk about.
General Motors was upset with the Wall Street Journal about a story in the mid-50s. I'm guessing 57 or 8.
They ran a spy photo, as I remember.
Yeah, and GM pulled all their advertising.
All their advertising.
And, you know,
a famous case.
I think it was either right before my dad took over PR or right after. But he argued vehemently, what are you doing? Do not do this. This is just the wrong thing to do. And so they made up. But that was the first publicized case of that.
Well, I remember when Road and Track would assemble its annual list of the best cars. This goes back to, I want to say, 1991, 1992. There was not a Lexus on the list. And Lexus hit the roof and pulled all their advertising because they hadn't made this best list.
Yeah.
And the next year, there was a Lexus on the list. And I'm not saying that that's why the magazine did it. I mean, Lexus makes good cars. But the point is, they did pull their advertising for the year. And that can really hurt a magazine financially, big advertiser like that.
Well, it's happened in recent years. There's been dust-ups. I'm sure Gene Jennings has stories.
Well, there's always dust-ups.
Yeah.
There always is. But for a client to yank its advertising, that's a pretty big move.
But it's happened in recent years.
It'll happen again. They do that and they get mad. And you shouldn't advertise in the publication to think you're buying something. You should advertise in a publication because the advertising helps you sell whatever it is that you're advertising. The content is what draws people to read whatever it is.
Uh-huh.
And whether or not, I mean, the interesting thing is we make such big distinctions with advertising. Readers don't. You know, I heard Meijer has something on sale.
Yeah.
And it's like a news story. There's a full page ad. Nobody wrote anything about Meijer. And, you know, they're always going to threaten.
Yeah.
Hey, we got to take a quick break here for one of our sponsor messages. And we have to thank Bridgestone for its support of Autoline After Hours. Check it out at BridgestoneTire.com. They've introduced their third generation of run-flat tires, and there's benefits on both sides of the equation in terms of benefits to automakers adapting run-flat and consumers as well. And you can get more information about that, why there's those kinds of advantages, at BridgestoneTire.com.
Was that an ad?
Yeah, that's right. You bet it was an ad. That's the only way they can get them on this show. And Chip, who was that?
Yeah, it is Channel 2.
Channel 2. You know, I sort of lost my train of thought back there a little bit ago because Channel 2 came in to shoot the show that you're on the show talking about all this stuff. And so that's when I looked up and said, oh, there's a guy with a camera there.
And I do want to clarify. I'm on here tonight because I gave my word I'd be on it a couple of weeks ago.
Yes, not, way before all this happened. Right. Not to.
I was hoping that Sharon and I would get a chance to talk, you know, about GM's cars.
Let's talk about Lieutenant Dan.
Although on the ethics point, I've been intentionally quiet because I feel like, to your point earlier, that, you know, the journal's in a different position. I mean, we, you know, it's a media conglomerate. Detroit, you know, GM was running ads on our front page while we were writing that they were going to go bankrupt. So, I mean, I'm like very aware of the fact that we have luxuries that, you know, I mean, we can pay for our cars, we can pay for the trips, and I also know what it's like to not be in that position, and it's not an easy one. But I think the idea that, you know, advertising is the only kind of ethical dilemma in journalism, I mean, because while they can't control, you know, while advertisers may not pull ads, I think there's as much of an ethical dilemma presented with things like source access and executive access, and will we talk to you, will we not talk to you, will you get this information? And I'd be less concerned about reporters who, you know, who are soft on companies because they drove their car for a week than reporters who are careful about companies because they don't want to lose access to, you know, a certain executive, you know, or something like that. And I think that's, you know, I think that's almost, you know, as bigger of an ethical problem as the, you know, the advertising line is.
Oh, interesting distinction. Real interesting.
I've turned down access. You know, I remember Selim Bingo asked me, do you want to meet with Ed Whitaker? I said, no. No interest.
Well,
And it didn't matter in the long run, Peter, because you knew he wasn't going to be here.
He wasn't going to be there. It was just like a cup of coffee, you know.
Sorry, Scott.
If all the executives are in Geneva and GM offers you a chance to go to Geneva,
why would you not go?
Why would you not go? And, you know, I mean, it's part of this business. And, you know, they do all kinds of things all over the place. And you want to try to go and be there for the official unveiling because that will generate more traffic to your website and that will do the things that you want. So if you don't go, you're behind.
Right. And, you know the drill, or I know the drill. If you get invited on something like that, you make sure you go to at least one of their dinners, go to their press conference, and then you're free to do whatever you want. And they know that's the gig. They got you to go, you know, to their dinner and make sure you attend their press conference. And usually they'll make their executives available, and that's worthwhile, too. But they know the drill. If they're going to bring a journalist to an auto show, most of the automakers are pretty good at knowing these people got to go out and fan out over the floor and go look at everything and other competitors. That's just how it works. So that's the interesting part, as I was getting at before, is, yeah, we take these trips, but part of the deal is the car companies know they're paying our way to go report on other companies as well.
And you get, say it's a GM trip that GM sent you, and you're sitting down with Mark Royce, and Mark Royce says, yeah, the cruise is a failure, and we're going to have to redo everything. You write that story. It's not like they cancel your ticket and say, you know, you can never go
on. Hitchhike home.
Yeah. I mean, if you feel beholden to them, then you're already in a bad place. Right. And if you feel obligated to write something nice about anybody.
But it gets back to what you were mentioning, Sharon. You don't want to lose that access.
Yeah, and I think it's even things that can be more subtle. Like, you know, I think there's been, I don't know that they, you know, there's been certainly many a colorful auto executive who, you know, on the kind of casual part of a ride and drive, which, you know, I don't go on anymore, you know, but might crack a joke or might say something that would, you know, if you could write a story about it, a lot of people would read it. The guy would get in, you know, or gal would get in trouble. But nobody does that because nobody wants to be the jerk who, you know, who called out the executive who, and I, you know, so I think there's a lot of stuff that just kind of, you know, can go under the radar. I mean, I think that's why a lot of the blogs are great. And a lot, you know, the people who are less, I mean, part of it is, you know, some of the stuff that doesn't rise to the level of things you would report in a story in the Detroit News or in the Wall Street Journal. But, you know, I think the things that people don't get called out on, you know, how much of that is because it's not news and how much of that is because nobody wants to be blacklisted for being the one who says something.
Yeah, but then it depends, too, because, you know, my friend and, you know, former colleague Jerry Flint was great at just excoriating people. And, you know, he would drive executives up the wall. But they'd still invite him to trips and press conferences because they had respect for him. And I think getting to your point there, Sharon, is that once you feel like you're beholden, like, oh, I don't want to miss going to all these beautiful resorts and getting all these trips and you're having the car. Once you're worried about that, it's the same thing as what you're talking about. Oh, I don't want to lose access to these executives. It's just not a different
level. Well, it's just as bad as advertising issues. I mean, you know, you just have to be good enough and be indispensable enough, and you have to let them know that you're going to get the information whether they talk to you or not, you know, and if you can't do that, then...
Plus, access can sometimes be overrated if they're always on, you know, they're always like, well, I can't, I'm not going to say that, or they will be so politically correct the whole time. It's just like, really? I came all the way over here to have this kind of conversation? It was not worth it, you know. But, you know, everyone wants that. You're right, off-the-cuff comment.
Well, look, you know, I'm sure we've all had that, where you get that access with them, and especially it's like a dinner, you're having drinks afterwards, and they get to relax a little bit. You get to really get to know them. They may say things on the understanding or even the specific, you know, verbal comment that this is off the record or background, or you let them know at some point, look, I'm just here. You know, we're just people now. We're off the job. We're after hours,
it's
right?
It's too bad a lot of that's gone away. I remember GM would have a suite at the Chicago Auto Show where there was an open bar and a constant poker game over the 2 or 3 days. And, you know, my dad was running GM PR back then. It was just like, that's what's GM suite, and that's what you did. And anyone could go, and you smoke cigars, play poker. No one reported anything because everyone looked forward to going to the Chicago show, to the GM suite, so that they could...
Put their hair down a bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think the downside of that is when the reporter side takes those things for granted. I think the plus side is if you understand a story, that you can then write a story that is meaningful to your readers. And if you have an idea of who the people are beyond just the figurehead that blurts out whatever it is they blurt out. And I also think that those relationships, there's plenty of things that people have told me that is off the record that I've never reported. I've never been able to put anything in the paper. That doesn't stop you from trying, and you know, you just continue to do it. But I think that by understanding it and one, being respectful of those things, that it makes a huge difference.
Well, it makes like you say, a huge difference because it can give you understanding on what you then do report on. So even if you don't spill your guts directly on what they told you, you can say, this is happening, and take these and those other things into consideration.
I mean, one example I could think of is recently I wrote a review about the Chrysler 200. The day before, I called Chrysler PR, the people I know over there, told them that the review was running, that it was not going to be that favorable. I wasn't asking for suggestions. No one would ever, if they know me, they know they're not going to get a suggestion. And I am telling them this so they can alert their executive staff. I consider that a professional courtesy. That, you know, that they are supplying you with a car, and you just do that, and I think that dampens the point of people getting really upset because they're already upset when they're opening a paper, and then they go, well, it's not that bad, and then they go online and it's even less bad.
Yeah, well, it is a professional courtesy because I'm sure any PR person would say they'd rather learn about it before their boss does.
Well, don't surprise people. And, you know, I mean, there's going to be times when you do it. But, I mean, Sharon has written really tough stories. Everybody's aware of what the story is. Our job is not to get you. It's not to have this big blowout in the paper. Your job is to serve your readers. And to serve your readers, you need to be able to present that stuff fairly and honestly and openly.
Speaking of advertising, John, do we have another ad to do?
As a matter of fact,
we do.
So I want to take a minute and thank Chevrolet for its support of Autoline After Hours. Check this out at chevrolet.com/cruise. You know, with that Ecotec engine, it offers pretty good fuel economy. In fact, what they like to point out is it gets better than fuel economy of a number of cars in its class, offers USB ports for your iPod, 40-gig hard drive, steering wheel-mounted audio controls, Bluetooth connectivity, and a whole bunch of other stuff. Check it out at Chevrolet.com/cruise, and that's C-R-U-Z-E. And, you know, this might just be a good time to get into rapid fire anyway.
Yeah.
Ben, let's bring up that graphic and get into it.
Ever.
Otherwise, we could be powerless.
Okay, here. Oh, boy, we got all kinds of them just pouring in right now. Let's see what goes. Hey, Ben, I see we got a phone call there. Why don't we bring in a phone call right off the top?
Well, this is Ronnie Schreiber from Oak Park, Michigan. I write for TTAC and my own site, Cars in Depth. In general, there's a question about access. I mean, there's all sorts of ethical things. We get access to people that the general public don't get access to. We get access to events that the general public don't get access to. And the question is, it's ultimately up to yourself. Are you going to be bought off by a lunch, or are you not? I don't think a lunch is going to buy me off. As long as I disclaim to my readers what the, who has given me what, and they understand what the biases are, I leave it to my readers to be intelligent.
Lunch in Maui.
Okay. That really wasn't a question.
Yeah.
You got another phone call, Ben? Yeah.
Well, here we got one from John, J.T. Thompson, the president of Event Solutions International. He says, I've often felt conflicted about what we do. Is it all a big sham, or do we do the right thing for the consumer? Scott has taken the high road on this issue, and he is right in this case. I am humbled by his integrity. Actually, I'm amazed by it. Pretty good.
We should point out who ESI is.
Mm-hmm. Well, go ahead.
Isn't that the company that distributes
all the cars away from me?
Yeah.
There are several companies out there who help these manufacturers, you know, prepare, store, deliver the cars to the media, pick them up. You know, it's a basic logistical nightmare, but
right.
That's one of the things that company does.
Youngblood from Cleveland says, Mr. Burgess, congratulations on sticking up for something you know way down deep in your heart is right. Many years ago, I gave up a career in law enforcement because I wasn't politically correct. It hurt for a long time, but I know I am a better person for it. And so I have extra bedrooms in my Cleveland home. You're welcome. Carte blanche. Gotta go. There's still some green beer to drink. That's right. It's St. Patty's Day. Oh, my God. We forgot to mention that. Let's see. Comment from Tony. Scott, what if Chrysler tried to hire you now to evaluate their vehicles internally, just like Bob Lutz hired some former journalist at GM? Would you take the job?
I think that would be the wrong message. No, I don't think I would. But I would like to say I have been absolutely blown away by the amount of support so many people have given me. Car makers, people that I've not said the nicest thing about all their vehicles, have gone out of their way to just send me their support. And they just say, is there anything we can do to help? And I don't know what I'm doing at this point.
Okay, this has got nothing to do with what we've been talking about. Steve wants to know, is the Nissan Leaf overstretching the range given the fallout that most owners say is closer to 50 to 70 miles, not the 100-plus miles? Well, I would say, you know, everything that you're reading about the Leaf of recent time has been in super cold weather, by and large, and that really knocks down the range of an electric car.
Yes.
Really nice.
Your mileage may vary, especially if it's 10 degrees out.
And right. You want to have heat in the car,
yeah.
Or listen to the radio.
If you put the heat on, you can see the...
let's see. Comment from Jim. In a former AMC Renault Jeep dealer Dodge built in the 60s, there's now a sign stating that coming soon Fiat of Tysons... I don't know. I don't think this is well written. I can't understand it. Comment from Jeff W. Does Scott think his review would have been edited if he had short hair?
I may have to get my hair cut, which is one of the things that I do worry about.
Comment from Wright Knight. Why not do a car with a large springs energy to move it? Wright Knight, that was tried in 1903. It don't work. 007 Mitch W. says, J.D. Power just came out with reliability figures for cars. Why do some cars like Mini do so well in the market, both retail and used, yet fall apart? Well, because these days you got to realize that even when in the J.D. Power ratings, the worst cars, I mean, it's not like thing years ago, you know, when cars really did fall apart. They're not that bad. And the other thing that you got to measure is things gone right. There's a lot of ways to measure quality. Things gone wrong is one way. Things gone right is another. And for cars like the Mini, for a lot of buyers, they don't care if there's a few niggling problems. That'll get fixed, and then they love the car. So, and that's true of many other vehicles as well. Mario Pizzi says, my question is regarding the new Volvo V60. What are the chances that Volvo brings this fabulous car to the North American market? If not, why not? Well, Mr. Auto Critic, what do you think?
Former. I like the V60. But, I don't know if it is planned on coming here.
Yeah, I don't know. That's their station wagon.
Yeah.
So, or one of their station wagons.
If they can pull off, anybody can pull off wagons, it's Volvo. And so.
That's right. Michael wants to know, when Mark Royce says that customers will see a variety of Corvette models in the future, do you think that GM will ever configure a Corvette for a tall guy like me?
Peter.
What do you think, Peter?
Probably not.
That's safe.
Mark from the Land of Oz. All right, a guy down under. He says, I have a new C6 Corvette, a 2010 Equinox, and a 2009 Focus, but he worries about the 10% ethanol, soon to be 15% or more. What is it doing to his beloved 1959 Corvette? Any thoughts? And he says, I visit Autoline daily and enjoy Autoline Detroit and After Hours each week. Thanks for all the inside information. You know, if you've been running gasoline in your 59 Corvette, and even though you say you're from Oz, does Oz run 10%? Does Australia have 10% ethanol?
I don't know.
But anyway, in the United States, if you've been putting gasoline in your car for, I would say, the last 15 years, chances are you have already been running it on E10.
Yeah.
Because that's what the EPA mandated years ago for an oxygenate to really make the gas burn more cleanly. It's almost impossible to buy pure gasoline anymore. And that's been true for quite a while. Let's see. What else have
Except
we got?
Except that station on Woodward that every summer sells racing pump gas.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, yeah.
You would know.
Yeah, it's like $6 a gallon or something.
Okay, comment from Prius Stud. He says, hey, John, did you see the Clean MPG forum post that Cruise got 72 MPGs on one guy's 15-mile commute? No, I don't believe that. Even though they're an advertiser and we thank them dearly, I don't believe 72 miles per gallon out of a Cruise. He says it's getting better than the EPA mileage from everyone who tests it. Well, you know, look, you park at the top of a hill and let the thing coast. There's tricks that you can play, but this guy's not going to drive that car for a week and get that kind of mileage. Okay, here's one for you, Peter, I think. Comment from Tim, what's everyone's thoughts on Lieutenant Dan's latest move, placing Straka as the CEO of Opel?
Well, that was to prepare the other guy for bigger things, right?
I don't know. Let's go to the GM expert. Sharon, yes. What do you think?
Well, I mean, I think Dan Akerson has been clear that he wants, you know, that not that he thinks that the folks at Opel are doing a terrible job, but that, you know, there's problems there. He'd like
They're
to see them.
Still losing money. They've been losing money for years.
He'd like them to be resolved quicker. He's impatient. He used that word, you know, and the guy, I mean, they, you know, and the guy they put in charge is known as being, you know, kind of an aggressive manager. So,
but what do you make of all the turmoil at GM? I mean, there's a lot of management movement, a lot of people leaving the company, a lot of people getting shuffled around,
a lot of people being moved around the company, a lot of people being gone around the company. You know, I think it's a, I mean, I think it's going into the IPO. I mean, one of the big concerns about GM was it had an untested management team. It had a team that hadn't worked together very much. So I think everybody would like to see, you know, a little bit more of a settled structure there. I'm sure GM would like to see a settled structure there. I don't think they were really, you know, wanting to lose their CFO right at this point, who resigned last week.
Have you seen Marianne Keller's comments?
No.
Oh, because we've had her on the show. We're going to have to get her back on, and I've only seen some reports about it. But she's taken a pretty snarky attitude about all this change going on at GM, like that it's a. She seems to be suggesting that Ackerson doesn't have things under control. That's what I'm reading.
Well, she's been reading the odd extremists. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there's a new CEO. There's going to be new executives under the CEO. So, I mean, I don't think a couple moves necessarily means that everything's falling apart. But I think it's definitely a wait-to-be-seen kind of issue. I mean, so Dan Ackerson has been there since September. He's been kind of focusing more on less on the IPO and more on the company for a few months now. So I think some turmoil is to be expected. And GM had a lot of problems, you know, so I think that's also not surprising. I think if we continue to see this kind of turnover, I mean, you know, now there's the team that is in place is basically the team that Dan Ackerson picks. If you see, you know, the four top positions switch again in the next 6 months, to me, that would be a lot more alarming than the fact that there's been a lot of change early in his tenure. And I think, you know, that's not a concern.
Mm. Good. Let's see here. Comment from DHGT. What's John's favorite auto manufacturer? I don't have a favorite. I'd say I'm impressed by some companies more than others. Mm. I'd say right now, Ford, Hyundai, Volkswagen impress me a lot in terms of what they're achieving. I know Volkswagen, some people think that they're hurting the brand, but I'm talking Volkswagen Group.
Money machine.
Money machine, right, exactly. So I don't know. Any others that people think are good?
That's a good list.
Porsche's okay.
Porsche's real impressive. They make a lot of money, and they don't sell a lot of cars.
Yeah.
And that's really impressive to make a lot of money. I mean, a lot of money with relatively low volume. Beauregard Jackson, what's the real impact of the Japanese earthquake on the auto industry? Boy, I don't think we know yet.
It's going to unfold over several months.
Yeah, over the next couple of months is really where you're going to see it, where we were talking earlier, if the computer chips disappear, we need those in cars.
Well, what I find interesting is at first all the Japanese said, oh, yeah, we'll be up and running by Wednesday, Thursday. Well, here it's Thursday. And now they're saying, yeah, we'll be running next Tuesday. And, you know, we're seemingly discovering that there's more destruction than what we thought. This nuclear thing seems to get worse by every day. And so I said all along, look, if it's a one-week disruption, no problem. There's enough slop in the system to take care of that, even with just-in-time delivery and whatnot. If it's 2 weeks, okay, now we got to worry about starting to expedite some things at the end of the 2 weeks. But if it goes beyond 2 weeks, there is absolutely going to be stuff shutting down, and not just in Japan.
Well, and there's General Motors today said they're shutting down a plant in Louisiana. So I think we're already starting to see it. I get the sense from talking to people that the concern behind closed doors is a lot greater than kind of, you know, the uniform calmness and the kind of prepared statements that we're seeing. You know, and it could be. If it's just a week, maybe it won't be a big deal. But, I mean, there's stuff that comes. It's not just, you know, engines and powertrains and cars. There's a lot of important things that come out of Japan.
And, you know, the point I keep making is you got to sell a car with every part on it.
Mm-hmm.
If you're missing one part, it can literally shut a plant down. Now, some stuff, they'll just fill the yard and they'll send guys out and stick stuff in. So if you're missing floor mats or cigarette lighters, who cares? But, you know, all you need is one critical component, and the plant shuts down.
And people aren't aware, I think, of how intertwined all of the car makers are with Japanese companies.
Right.
You know, the made in American car, I mean, I think that one of the most recent studies said it's the most made in America is the Camry.
And for passenger car, that's true.
And so it's
you know, you don't know if there's some little bit that is coming from Japan that's part of that car. And like you said, it needs every piece.
Undoubtedly. Bob in Atlanta wants to know, is it too early to speculate about any possible changes to Toyota's North American assembly plant strategy due to the situation in Japan? Like maybe move more production here, I think is what he's getting at. Maybe, because we've seen the yen go to 78 to the dollar. It's like, and, you know, Toyota is pretty open that, you know, if it goes under 80, forget it. You know, we can't make money. So I think with certain Lexuses they could, but, you know, base cars, no. So I don't, any other thoughts of what Toyota might change in strategy?
Well, they've canceled overtime here in the U.S. just immediate as an immediate response. I mean, I think it'll be interesting to see the currency. They talked to, we talked to Bob Carter a few weeks ago, and he was, you know,
Bob Carter from Toyota.
Yeah,
right?
Bob Carter from Toyota, who, you know, who's a American official, but, you know, obviously, you know, he knows the company, and he said, you know, they're not going to shift production or do anything in response to currency changes, and generally companies don't want to do that, but, you know, it'll be interesting to see how far you can take that.
Yeah, it will be, and I think we'll know pretty quickly. Boy, I hope Japan gets back on its feet fast.
Yeah, absolutely.
It could be bad for everyone, and it's obviously horrific for them. BKW says, what about the benefits that publishing companies enjoy in the relationship between car makers and journalists? Everyone beats on the riders, but magazine publishers can offer their employees cars, trips, and involvement in an interesting industry and pay very little in the news gathering process. They don't pay the journalists that much either. Well, welcome to the editorial world.
And the publisher is the only person that wears both hats. You know, that they oversee everything, and that's the only person that does. Everything else splits.
Mm-hmm. Tony Gray wants to know, Scott, do you think that online reviews will completely replace printed versions?
I think online eventually is going to completely replace print. But I think that the real key has been that the way the information is given, it's not going to just be a printed online version of the newspaper. It's going to be video, and it's going to be interactivity, and it's going to be all of these other elements that you can do online that you can't do in a printed newspaper. There's still room for a printed paper, and I think most newspapers make their money from the printed paper, not from what's online. But lots of publications are making lots of money online without a printed edition.
Sure, and the Journal did it right from the very beginning,
yeah,
wasn't it? You never gave away anything free online, did you?
No, and that's the big—I mean, I remember even being at the news where they talked about studies that showed what happened, not even when you charged people for online, but when you asked people to answer a few questions before they could proceed in the site. And there was some huge number of drop-off because people were not only not willing to not pay for articles, they weren't willing to say, I'm male, female, and this is my zip code. So, yeah, I mean, it's a luxury that the Journal has because they made a decision to charge people for online content up front, which is, you know, but it's different. I mean, but I don't think the rules that apply to the Journal necessarily apply to everyone else, given our, you know, our subscribers. And, you know, there's a Wall Street contingent that sees us as important to doing business. So, you know, it's kind of a different mentality, I think.
This one probably should have come in sooner because it's sort of repetitive. But Mike Vorobej says, as you well know, there's worldwide speculation that you have rewritten the online review of the Chrysler 200 to please an advertiser. This action is a direct insult to the intelligence of Detroit news readers and has apparently resulted in the resignation of Scott Burgess. I bet you didn't know about that yet, Scott.
I'm just catching up.
Who happens to be your best writer in the auto section. Perhaps you need to be reminded of the old adage that you serve your advertisers best by serving your readers first.
I didn't know that was an old adage, but that's great.
Sounds like Benjamin Franklin might have said that one. Rob Render wants to know, jumping topics completely here, what's happened to our speedometers? 10-mile-an-hour increments are gone. Suddenly, every car has 20-mile-per-hour increments. Is that right?
No.
There's a lot, and I wish
there's a lot.
All cars would have a 70 mile per hour at the top of the speedometer, clearly written, so I'm not driving 80.
You don't want to drive 80?
Oh, I like driving 80, but there's times when I shouldn't drive 80.
I like analog gauges, but I like the digital
readout
speedometer in the center that you can dial up in certain cars. That's really helpful.
So since getting a GPS that shows my speed, I realized that speedometers are often just not right. So, like, I didn't get a ticket for 2 years, which was unusual for me. And then I realized that my speedometer was 6 miles an hour under. Or, oh, it was said it was 6 miles an hour faster than it actually was.
That's funny.
Which may have been done on purpose. Who knows?
Dave Sproul says, I'm in the market for another car, or rather, my wife is. So I read a lot of reviews for several sources. My wife favors the Hyundai Elantra Limited. By most accounts, this is a very great car, but when we go to the local lots, we cannot find any. I see a bucket load of Sonatas and SUVs, but no Elantras. Any ideas as to why? Well, I think it's easy. I mean, they're just launching the Elantra,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, they're just ramping them up.
They just cleaned out inventory of the old ones, I would imagine, to make room for the new ones, and they're still ramping up the new ones, right? Are they out yet?
Yeah, they're out.
Okay.
I think it came out
at the very end of December. Okay, but there's probably not a whole lot in the pipeline is my guess. So that's...
Give it some time.
Yeah. Let's see. Joe Zymek wrote in. All right, Joe. He says 55% of car buyers are female, and 80% of the car buying decision is female. When women find out they don't have to go to a gas station, that will drive the electric vehicle, hybrid electric vehicle, plug-in vehicles.
Well, because women can't pump gas? What? What? I know, I find gas pumping so terrifying that I would pay $20,000 more so I didn't have to do it as often.
Oh, this I'd have to look up to answer. Jason Jadosh says, I didn't hear anything on your monthly sales report about Camaro Mustang Challenger sales figures. Any update? Well, Camaro is at the top of the list right now. It's handily outselling the Mustang. And I'd have to get the sales figures out, but I know the Mustang's got a decent lead.
A couple
on
people
the
had pointed out that it, at the end of February, that Challenger was very close to the Mustang.
Really? Wow.
And,
I'm surprised to hear that.
The Camaro is way ahead, and I think it's going to probably pull further ahead through the year because of the convertible.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, Miradart, question for the panel. Could Toyota restart NUMMI? That's a good question.
Not anytime soon.
No, I mean, everybody's looking at these long-term solutions to a short-term problem.
Yeah.
And I mean, I don't see any significant change. The yen rate is the bigger deal, and that's why you want to have localized production. Yeah. So
it would take Toyota, who knows, a year, 18 months to restart NUMMI.
Hmm. Simple Jack wants to know, haven't some of the buff books been notoriously on the take for years?
In the old days,
that would have been true.
In ancient automotive magazine history, yes, Motor Trend's Car of the Year was bought and paid for, because when I was at BBDO Detroit, Dodge's ad agency, we were asked...
You bought a couple of Car of the Years, did you?
No, we were asked to pitch. We were asked to show. I had to muster my troops and present a campaign to Motor Trend on what would we do if the Dodge Lancer won Car of the Year. So we had to actually do a campaign and show it to them.
But, you know, and just to point out one last thing is...
It didn't win.
I think that one of the reasons that my particular story has been a big
resonated.
Deal... Resonated. ...is, one, it's not that often we come across this dilemma. The vast majority, the overwhelming majority of auto journalists are ethical, that they know what's right, and they do what's right. That this comes up very rarely.
Uh-huh.
And even in this case, I don't think it's as direct or as simple. It's certainly not a black and white thing. And on the other side, the PR side, they're just as ethical. The PR people have an ethical stance that they have to take. They don't go out there and just boldly lie. And we meet those people, and when they do, you go, oh, man, that guy's really full of shit. But most of them are not. Most of them, if they can't tell you the real answer, they tell you, I can't tell you the real answer. They don't make something up.
Right.
And
that's absolutely right.
And so, I mean, that's, you know, one of the things that I think that we need to remember is that no one is on the take, and when it's purported that it is, that's why it's such a big deal.
Here's one for you, Peter. Bradley wants to know, In response to the announcement about Buick and their new ad campaign, what does history tell us about the success of car commercials that do not show cars? And I guess we should preface that by saying Buick's launching this big campaign showing sports highlights.
Probably not great. I mean, we're not talking a Nike commercial, you know, that can show all kinds of things and just intermittently show a Nike swoosh. I think Buick is going down the wrong road here. I really do.
Here's another one. Camaro, Stang, Challenger. Retro success makes me wonder why GM fought retro GTO styling, as it's clearly that segment of buyer's interest. Was it those in charge at the time who were to blame? Wish they had to do it over again.
Well, he's talking about the Australian
GTO, right. The Holden, right.
They couldn't do it. Well, Lutz wanted it here.
Now.
Wanted a GTO. The quickest way to do it was to bring that car over, put a Pontiac grill on it, and call it good.
Right.
And it was I love the car.
Right. But it wasn't.
It wasn't a GTO.
It wasn't a GTO. That's right. They just threw that name on.
But you know what? Nothing would have been a GTO.
Correct. So. Well, they could have done it, but it would have taken another 3 years.
Yeah. Before,
and you're right. Lutz wanted it right now. Peter, any update on a new Trans Am series?
No, the current Trans Am series is a joke and remains a joke, but the manufacturers are not willing to jump into the current Trans Am. So, you know, they've got 26 cars at Sebring for tomorrow's race. After that, they'll have like a dozen, you know, so it's a mess. But no plans for a new one.
Okay, Mr. Former Auto Critic, you think you're so good. George from Brooklyn wants to know, what is the car equivalent of Snooki?
Oh, God. The Cube.
He came up with an answer. That's pretty good. I'm impressed. And I think it does work.
Sorry.
Okay, Eric Wasiloff on Facebook wants to know, what do you think of Lamborghini's new plan to lease the Gallardo? Will other supercar manufacturers follow suit?
Who knows?
And
most of those cars, you know, you pay cash. And if you get disgruntled like that Chinese guy, you destroy it on camera.
Oh, that's right.
Okay, well, I think we're getting down to the end here. Joseph wants to know, I know there's a lot of news this week, but you got to talk about gas prices, expecting to be $4.25 a gallon this summer. What's Detroit's business plan for this?
It's already over $4 in California. I think our new minimum's $3.50, probably. The manufacturers are much better shaped than they were 3 years ago. I mean, Chevrolet's got the Cruze, Ford's got the Focus and the Fiesta. Chevrolet's going to have the Sonic.
The real turn's going to be if consumers are going to the American car dealers for fuel-efficient vehicles.
Right.
Because right now they think, I have to go to an Asian car dealer.
Yeah, there's still the legacy of Detroit can't build a good small fuel-efficient vehicle.
Yeah, I mean, that's not going to change overnight. I mean, I don't think anyone at GM, Ford, or Chrysler would say they're thrilled to see people decide to suddenly buy small cars. You know, and I think, you know, GM, Ackerson at GM said, you know, we're not as ready as we'd like, the industry isn't as ready as we'd like to be. You know, and I think that was probably the most honest assessment, that as much as there's small cars out there, I mean, people still think Toyota and Honda when they think small car.
Sure they do. And, you know, the other thing, too, is nobody makes all that much money on small cars. Mm-hmm. And so, sure, even if they had the capacity to fulfill all the market's need with small cars, they really don't want to see that happen just from a profitability standpoint.
Yeah, and they just need some time. I mean, a lot of the American small cars are just objectively better than they were before. But that doesn't mean it's sunk into people's consciousness now. I mean, it's not, you know, they've been out there. You know, GM's Cruze has been out there a few months. The Focus has been out there less than a year. So it's still pretty early in their life cycle.
But they're doing pretty good. I mean, you know, Fiesta is at the head of the class right mm-hmm. now. It's outselling the Honda Fit.
Yeah.
Accord really took it on the chin last month. And, you know, Fusion and Cruze did quite well. So I think it's starting to happen.
Right.
Starting to. Okay, we'll make this the last one. Salvador G. wants to know, what's the part of a car that you guys and lady would review with the most objectivity and harshness the engine of a car, the chassis, the interior, overall design, or build quality, and what can be the good points of a car that you would consider acceptable of a bad car, or in this case, the Chrysler 200. But
that's, you know, that's a show and a half.
Yeah. I think the easy answer is it's the overall car. It's the total package that you're buying. You know, we've all driven cars that have killer engines in them and can't handle the crash.
Yeah, if the suspension can't handle the power, nothing fits, nothing works together, you're looking for seamless execution. It feels right.
I think that's the car you're buying. I mean, I think that's the way you buy cars. I mean, I don't think people are always buying the whole car. I mean, I think people with big cars want cars that'll fit a dog. And, you know, people with big dogs want, you know, cars that'll fit a dog. I think, you know, I mean, I don't hear, like, most people who aren't, like, fellow auto journalists, I don't hear them talk about, like, I need the engine and the fit. And, I think it's just, you know, a car that won't break down, a car that'll have resale value, and a car that, like, looks nice and cute on the outside.
No, I would totally agree with what you're saying, because what the people actually buy is the most important thing that goes on, not necessarily what the critics or the former critics
ask me, well, what should I buy? And, you know, it's like you watch focus groups, and focus groups always say, well, I want fuel efficiency, safety,
right,
blah, blah, blah. And I've had people ask me for advice, and I, you know, go through the drill, here, consider this, and they give you this. I remember, I forget who it was years ago, this woman said, well, okay, and she gave me her descriptors, and I said, well, there's a Camry buyer.
Right.
Okay, so look at a Camry, look at a car. Heard from her, a couple months ago, what'd you have? Oh, I got a Mustang convertible.
Yeah.
I've had people call me and ask and compare, I want to get a Jeep Wrangler or a Camaro.
Yeah.
And, you know, which is better.
Right.
And it really depends on where you are.
Yeah.
You know, if you're in a ditch, you might want the Wrangler.
But it's funny, you know, in focus groups, everyone will always say, you know, the conservative, yeah, this is what I want.
Well, they'll tell pollsters whatever they think is the correct thing to say.
Yeah, and then they'll go out and get in their, you know, 400 horsepower or whatever.
Wasn't the Aztec the most best-tested group among focus groups?
Might have been.
You know, that it checked all the check marks on a box.
What tent?
It's like the Consumer Association of America or some such, you know, NGO kind of thing, came out with a poll this week saying Americans want more hybrids and more electrics and more plug-ins. And it's like, well, why don't they buy what's there right now?
Yeah, Americans say that, but when they go to the dealer and say, well, it's $2,500 to $5,000 to X amount more, they say, oh, no, that 40 miles per gallon on that gas-powered whatever is looking pretty good right now.
Well, Jack Narrett over at Kelley Blue Book told me, he goes, a lot of the things like hybrids are just like public transportation. You want your neighbors to use it so that the roads are a little clearer for you.
Right.
And there's a lot of truth to that. That, you know, we want our neighbors to be really environmentally sensitive so that I could
get ahead. Well, it's like all this budget discussion that's going on right now. Everybody agrees the budget has to be cut. But don't touch my stuff at all.
That's like when the auto industry had to eliminate dealers. You get the dealers in a room and you give them the fire and brimstone on speech and say, yes, we have to contract to get better. And then it's just, as long as those other guys' dealers, not my dealer.
Well, hey, we ought to wrap it up here, too, because I got to let my people free and get them home. But, Scott, thanks so much for coming on.
Well, thank you for having me.
And I know this was arranged weeks ago before this all happened, but I'm glad we had you on tonight.
It's been a very interesting week, the most interesting one I've had in a long time. So people have been so supportive, car makers, other journalists. I have literally 50 or 60 people from Facebook that I need to reply to all the messages. And it's one where I've joked that I'm just glad that I wasn't real mean the whole time I was an auto critic, that I think that people think that I'm genuine, and I'm proud to sit here and have gone through this last week, and I really don't think I would have much other choice to do it much differently.
Well, it's good, and I know we'll have you back here, and it'll be still auto critiquing.
Yes, I hope
just
so too.
For somebody else.
I wore a suit tonight or a jacket at least, because
it's the best he's looking about.
Yeah,
5 years.
When you got a job, you can go with a T-shirt.
If BMW send us some cars to review, I'll just have Scott do them for Auto Extreme.
There you go. And Sharon Turlip, thanks so much for coming on tonight, too. And we've got to have you back, too, and talk more GM stuff in the future. That'll be great.
For sure.
And Peter, as always,
John,
great.
Another exciting episode.
Cool.
Yeah, next time I want to talk about cars. Journalists talking to journalists about journalism is...
We do that one show. We got it done.
On a car
next
show.
Time it's cars.
It's
the deal.
When John and I want to talk about racing, we just go do a show for ourselves in private.
Well, thanks, folks, for tuning in. Really appreciate it.
Visit our website, outoflinedetroit.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily automotive news fix with Out of Line Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Out of Line Detroit. That's all there and much more at outoflinedetroit.tv.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence, and by Chevrolet, the all-new Chevrolet Cruze. Get used to more